About an hour after the first strike in New York, a plane crashed into the Pentagon, collapsing one side of the building. Another plane crashed in Pennsylvania. The White House was evacuated. The president, who was in Florida, was rushed to a secure location.
Hundreds of people who were aboard the planes that crashed, the death toll from this day could be in the thousands.
8:45 a.m., New Yorkers were arriving at work, picking up a bagel or a cup of coffee on the way, when today's first wave of calamitous news was announced. Newscasters reached for precedent. 60 years ago, a plane had crashed into the Empire State Building. People watched on television, and they also watched through the windows of apartments and office buildings that faced downtown. And then they saw the event repeated at the second tower. It will no doubt be days before all the black boxes are retrieved and all the dead and injured are accounted for. It will certainly be a lot longer than that before the people who were in downtown Manhattan this morning ever forget this experience. NPR's Melissa Block was near the World Trade Center and is with me now. And Melissa, if one had to pick a place in the United States or in New York as dense with people as you possibly could, it would be at the World Trade Center.
Lower Manhattan, and thousands of people coming to work in this congested area, and many of whom, as you mentioned, saw exactly what happened. I spoke with a worker at a construction site just north of the World Trade Center named Murray Goff. They were there. He had just flown in yesterday from West Virginia to work on this site. He was standing there at his work site, and he hears one jet flying low overhead.
And we heard it go over, and we looked up, and then we heard the crash. Run out here and look and seen the plane where it went into the side. We're standing here, can't believe it, still looking at it. Whenever the second plane crashed through the smoke into the other one, well, as soon as I seen that plane hit, I said, it's a terrorist attack. They better call Red Alert, all of our federal buildings. I mean, that's the only thing it could be, because it came in right above us and just banked and went into the building.
Came in right over your head?
Yeah, right over here, just right over like that and just banked. You can see it was an American airline. I didn't see the American airline, but some of the workers looked up and seen the plane and noticed it was an American Airlines.
And Red Alert or whatever, police instantly were called in, firefighters were called in, everyone was there.
Thousands. And the tragedy here is that firefighters and emergency personnel did what they're supposed to do. They responded to the scene. They rushed into those buildings after the planes crashed. And then there are expected to be many, many casualties of those workers who were there when the buildings collapsed on them. I spoke with a lieutenant from the Port Authority Police named Thomas Innes, who was covered with debris. He was basically muddy ash head to toe. He was there. He responded to the scene after the planes went into the building. He saw people jumping out of the towers from maybe 70 or 80 stories out there, up above. There were reports of a man and a woman holding hands as they jumped from the building to try to escape. And he was there when the buildings came down.
I guess the scariest part was being covered in dust and not being able to see and breathing through my hat.
You couldn't see anything?
No, you couldn't see anything. It was pitch black.
And you were breathing through your police hat?
My hat, yes, because that's all I had with me.
The people who were jumping, did you see them fall?
Unfortunately, yes. It's not something I would like to talk about, and unfortunately, it's not something I'll ever be able to forget about. At first, you thought it was pieces of the building falling until you realized that they had arms and legs. And at this point, I really wouldn't want to say anything more about it.
The World Trade Center towers, which are now mostly rubble, where once there were these symbols of Lower Manhattan, are more than symbols. This is where people live their real workaday lives, where they take their children. This is part of a big live city.
Absolutely. And everywhere you went today, you saw people looking at this cloud of smoke clustered around radios. People had car doors open with the radios blasting. People gathered around to hear what had happened. I spoke with one man. You also saw a lot of people rushing to pick up their kids from school and from daycare. I talked to Michael Ruddy, who was just picking up his son, his six-year-old son, from school. And he mentioned that until last year, his wife worked at the World Trade Center. What did you tell your son?
Excuse me. I'm very emotional about this. I explained to him that something very terrible had happened, that the World Trade Center, which he knows very well, because he used to call it Mama's Building. I told him that it had been hit by an airplane and had now been destroyed and it doesn't exist anymore. He's, I think, concerned because he sees how sad I am. He kind of sees the sadness.
A New Yorker who shared that experience earlier today with NPR's Melissa Block.
Here in Washington, less than an hour after the second plane crashed into the World Trade Center, a third aircraft sliced into the Pentagon. Dozens of people were sent to area hospitals. Many of the seats of power in the nation's capital, the White House, the Capitol, the Treasury, and State Departments were evacuated. And 2 hours later, United Airlines confirmed a fourth plane crash near Pittsburgh with no reports of survivors among the 45 on board. NPR's Peter Kenyon joins us now. Peter, let's back up to the crash at the Pentagon. What do we know about that so far?
Well, the initial reports were fairly sketchy, but after it soon became apparent that this was a very heavy hit that the building had taken, and the five-sided building, it was one side of it was just sliced from top to bottom. There was a huge gaping hole and a bright orange fireball, and one side of it had been punctured heavily. Just been some renovations there recently, which was in some ways a blessing because they'd put in blast-proof glass and things like that. But there was still a potential for very heavy injuries and possibly fatalities. Military officials said the fire was intense. Hospitals reported at least 40 victims, some in critical condition, 7 in critical as of mid-afternoon. It was apparently hard for rescue workers to get in there because of the heavy fire and smoke. There was a plane, an American Airlines plane, of 64 people aboard. One FBI official on the scene said he believed that was the plane that suddenly veered off route and ran into the Pentagon.
So to be clear about it, a commercial airliner hits the Pentagon this morning.
That's right. Just right into it. Often there's a helicopter pad nearby, and it just went right in there.
Now, a lot of people in the nation's capital shocked. It seemed to be an attack not just on the military at the Pentagon, but on the very symbol of the United States.
I think it was, and I think the fact that it came so soon in conjunction with the World Trade Center attacks that made it even more devastating for people. Rapid evacuation, as you mentioned, at the top of all of these buildings. And on any given day, you know, a lot of the people here in town are tourists, and those in front of the White House were being yelled at by agitated Secret Service agents. They didn't quite know what to do. Reporters were finding congressmen and senators hanging around on the lawn of the Capitol because they'd been evacuated. The president traveled from Florida to Louisiana, where he made a brief statement, and then on to Nebraska, where he convened a meeting of the National Security Council. And Karen Hughes today said she repeated his pledge that they would use every resource first to help the victims and then to track down whoever's responsible for this.
We have two planes that hit the World Trade Center. We have one that hits the Pentagon. A fourth aircraft goes down near Pittsburgh.
That's right. And this was the hardest to connect. But there was an emergency call. An emergency official in the Pennsylvania area got a call from a passenger. A man who identified himself as a passenger said he was in the bathroom of this plane, and he kept saying, "We've been hijacked, we've been hijacked." And he said, "This isn't a hoax." And then the dispatcher reportedly heard an explosion and lost contact with the caller. There's reportedly 45 people aboard that plane, and an emergency worker there in Pennsylvania said there were no sign of survivors.
Thank you, Peter. NPR's Peter Kenyon.
The planes involved in today's four deadly crashes were hijacked from airports in Newark, Washington, and Boston. Details of how airport security in those cities was so dramatically breached are not yet clear. But the hijackings mean routine security procedures from X-ray machines to employee background screening will be scrutinized for vulnerabilities. And there may be limits to how much protection Titan Security can offer. NPR's Emily Harris joins us now. Emily, what do we know about how these people managed to hijack these planes?
We know very little at the moment, Linda. That really is the question of the day. Security experts want to know exactly how teams managed to get into the airport. There's basically two ways that you can get to planes, either through the passenger side, and most people who have taken any sort of air travel are familiar with that. Go in, you show your ID, you answer a couple of questions about your baggage, and then go through a metal detector. The other way that planes are accessible are on the so-called ramp side. It's the people who work there, the cleaners, the food handlers, the baggage handlers, and the mechanics. And the very basic question that security officials want to find out is which side was breached for this terrorist attack.
And how hard would it be, do you suppose, to breach either side?
Well, security experts have been telling me that for something this scale, this coordinated, it would have taken a number of months of planning either side. You've got to scope out the areas. You've got to find the vulnerabilities at the particular airports. There's a lot of speculation at this point going on among airline security people regarding how this happened. One person suggested to me that whoever carried out this attack may have tried to stockpile weapons ahead of time on the secure side of the airport somehow and been able to access them quickly. It this is a really big question right now. How did people get through, and what can be done to tighten security?
And what about people who were somehow able to control these planes over distance, flying them into specific targets?
That's actually fairly tough, according to some people I've talked to. And there seems to be consensus that the group that carried out this attack had trained pilots with them. Partially, people have told me they think that because they find it really hard to believe a pilot for United or American Airlines would fly his plane, his or her plane, into the Pentagon or into the World Trade Center. One question that's definitely going to come out in this investigation is, when was it clear that these planes were off course, and what exactly did air traffic officials do at that point?
How much tighter could airline security get? Is there any indication? Emily, I think we're going to run out of time here, Emily, but yes or no, do we know when we're going to start flying again in this country?
Don't know. The earliest would be noon Eastern tomorrow.
Thanks very much, Emily Harris.
You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. I'm Noah Adams. A few hours ago, New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani gave reporters the latest information on injuries from today's terrorist attacks.
600 people are being treated in local hospitals, and there are 150 in particular that were critical, that were moved by EMS. New York City has 170 hospitals, and we're utilizing all of them.
To bring us up to date on the extent of the casualties and injuries, we turn now to NPR's Rick Carr, who's in New York. Rick, I know people are very hesitant about doing this, but can you put any number yet on the number of estimated dead and injured in the city?
Well, beyond what we heard from Mayor Giuliani in that cut of tape, there's very little sense of it. Communication has been difficult in New York today, and the hospital workers have an awful lot on their hands, more important things than answering pesky reporters' questions. You know, Mayor Giuliani did say at that press conference that the number of casualties will be more than any of us can bear. There were about 1,500 people who arrived almost immediately after the two planes hit at a park in Lower Manhattan. They were the walking wounded. They were taken to area hospitals. The New York Police Department told the Associated Press earlier this afternoon that likely thousands of people are dead. 40 or 50,000 people work in the World Trade Center towers. The questions are how many hadn't yet arrived to work, how many stayed away at the last minute, how many made it out of the building. We just don't know the answer to those questions.
And you're surveying the scope of the injuries at the hospitals in New York. How is that going?
Yeah, Mayor Giuliani says that all 170 of the hospitals in New York have been called into action. There's no sort of central number, but here are some examples. At St. Vincent's, which is the hospital nearest the World Trade Center, as of 2 p.m. Eastern time today, they had 184 people who had come through. Two were dead. That hospital is now full, and they're taking injured people to other hospitals. Bellevue, a large hospital in Lower Manhattan, or not in Lower Manhattan, but downtown anyway, is a little farther away. They, at 3 p.m., had 120 minor injuries, 20 major injuries. Two people arrived dead on arrival, and two people went straight into an operating room. Most hospitals are saying 10 to 20% of the cases they're seeing are in critical condition, and right now it does look like hundreds of people in New York area hospitals. Meanwhile, Brooklyn and Queens hospitals are reportedly moving their non-critical patients out to the Long Island suburbs in order to make room for more people coming in from Manhattan.
And what kind of injuries are showing up there?
Lots of smoke and dust inhalation. That cloud that has hung over New York City all day long has been just pernicious. New York University Hospital has been handing out dust masks. I spoke to a friend this afternoon who said that in Brooklyn Heights, it looked like it was snowing this afternoon. The dust was coming down so heavily. Cuts and scrapes. A woman told the Brooklyn Hospital that she was in her high-rise office building when the window shattered. Something lacerated her leg. She turned and looked and said it was an aircraft gauge. Lots of broken bones, and some of the more severe cases have been burns, crushing, and other severe bodily trauma.
And for sure, a serious need for blood in New York?
Absolutely. The hospitals are saying right now they need blood. They in particular need type O blood, which is the so-called universal donor. Hospitals all over New York City have lots of people waiting in line to give blood. Bellevue Hospital told me about an hour ago that they had people packing their waiting room waiting to give blood. They're asking people to go to hospitals in the outer boroughs or uptown in Manhattan because the lower Manhattan hospitals are just swamped with casualties right now.
And what is it like to be outside, to be on the other side of Manhattan Island?
Everybody is just numb in Brooklyn. There were people lining the Brooklyn waterfront today, just sitting there numbly staring across the East River, trying to make sense of this. And the human tragedy is just so incomprehensible right now that most people were just remarking on the fact that those two beacons, those two symbols of New York, were just gone. They weren't there anymore. And that in itself is hard enough to get your head wrapped around.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you, Noah.
NPR's Rick Carr speaking with us from New York. Back now to our colleague Robert Siegel in New York, who was out today talking to people at Grand Central Station.
In midtown Manhattan this morning, mobs of commuters who had barely arrived at work struggled to leave the city. They streamed en masse up and down the avenues, and as they looked downtown, they could see a huge cloud of dust, smoke, and debris in the sky, obscuring the skyscrapers of the financial district. The evidence of the collapse of the World Trade Center towers hung in the sky all day. At 42nd Street, people headed for Grand Central Terminal. At 10:50 this morning, they found the doors to the railroad station shut and blocked by transit police. Then, just before 11, the transit police got word by walkie-talkie that another entrance to the station just down the block was about to open. From every direction, people walked into the station. The empty hall of Grand Central filled up in no time, and by 11:05, thousands of commuters seeking an exit to the suburbs stood watching for news of a departure. Among them, Surendra Patel, an accountant, and Roseanne Rotunda, who works for Pfizer.
I'm trying to get to White Plains, which is not where I live. It's just where my husband works. I'm just trying to be anywhere but here.
Anywhere but Manhattan.
Right. No. Pretty much.
I'm trying to go to Scarsdale. And, terrible. I saw the building, second building collapsing myself. Terrible. Just terrible.
By 11:10, though, the police spread the latest orders.
No trains. Evacuate the building. I have no idea.
Attention, please. Please evacuate Grand Central. Go to the nearest exit. Evacuate Grand Central Terminal now.
And with uncharacteristic discipline, no doubt born of fear, the crowd that had just filled the station left it empty once again. The subways were closed, Hudson River crossings were shut, the buses were packed. Those with cell phones used them, those without lined up at payphones. At 34th Street, there was suddenly word that the Queens Midtown Tunnel was open. A large air-conditioned bus, a Hampton Jitney it was called, pulled up to a curb. And when its front door opened, police officer Mike Pletus addressed the crowd that was waiting outside.
Everybody gets off and Maurice Avenue.
Fine, fine.
Officer, where's Maurice Avenue anyway?
Even if some of these people didn't know where Maurice Avenue was, that didn't seem to matter. It was someplace closer to home, and it was someplace safer.
Here is a review of today's story. Four commercial airliners crashed this morning, two into the World Trade Center towers in New York, one into the Pentagon, and one on the ground near Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The crashes were the biggest terrorist attack ever.
In Washington, the White House and the Capitol building were evacuated. Injured from the Pentagon were taken to local hospitals. President Bush ordered the nation's military to high alert status. The Federal Aviation Administration has grounded all domestic commercial flights until noon tomorrow, if not longer.
There was chaos all day in New York City. Both of the World Trade Center towers collapsed into the street. Bridges and tunnels into Manhattan were closed. So were financial markets. Police estimated there would be thousands of people injured or killed, but no definite count until tomorrow. We'll be following the story throughout the rest of the day and tonight. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.
This is special coverage from NPR News of today's terrorist attacks. I'm Robert Siegel in New York.
And in Washington, D.C., I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. Today, the worst act of terrorism anywhere, ever. Perhaps thousands were killed.
Four commercial jets were hijacked and crashed into civilian and military targets. Two into the World Trade Center, one into the Pentagon. One outside Pittsburgh.
President Bush ordered the nation's military to high alert status.
All flights in the U.S. were grounded.
All the financial markets were closed.
And many federal and state offices around the country were closed to protect against any other possible attacks.
We're going to New York now to hear from Andrea Bernstein, who is in Brooklyn, actually. Andrea, what is
Hi,
it
like? How are you?
I'm fine. What is it like as people are trying, I suppose, at this time of evening to get out of Manhattan?
Well, I am standing at the foot of the Manhattan Bridge in Brooklyn, and there are thousands of people streaming off the bridge. It looks like the New York Marathon, although, of course, women are dressed in high heels, men are dressed in business attires. People have told me that they've come from Upper Manhattan, about a 5 to 6 mile walk to get here, and many have many more miles to go.
Would walking be their only choice?
Walking appears to be the only choice to get out of Manhattan and into Brooklyn. Once they're in Brooklyn, there is bus and train service out towards outer Brooklyn, Queens, and Long Island. But to get here, many of them were told you have to walk. I've seen women who are 9 months pregnant. I've seen families waiting with strollers for women who were coming over from the other side with their babies that they'd taken out of daycare in Manhattan. And a sea of people like I've never seen before. This street that I'm on, Flatbush Avenue, a major thoroughfare, is closed to all but emergency vehicles and the thousands of people walking by.
Now, it has not been possible throughout this day to go over into Manhattan from Brooklyn.
No, it's been blocked off for much of the day by any means. This is definitely the afternoon commute. I've been watching people all day coming over into Brooklyn. The earlier people were people who were very near the blast, and many of them told me that some of them were outside. They said it was complete and utter darkness. The sky blacked out, and all they could see was a glimmer of light from the East River, so they walked towards it.
The first plane hit the first tower this morning at 8:45. What can you see in the sky now over Manhattan from Brooklyn?
Well, it is a gorgeous, sunny September day here in New York. And there is a huge plume of brownish-gray smoke coming from Manhattan that has completely blotted out the sun. Every now and then you get an eerie view of the sun looking sort of orangey-red behind the smoke. But there is no more sunshine in this part of Brooklyn. Behind the plume of smoke.
And any sort of smell coming across the river there?
The smell has mitigated quite a lot. It was much worse earlier in the day, and people were holding handkerchiefs to their mouth. Here in Brooklyn, which is about probably a mile or two from the blast, they were wearing masks of the type that construction workers use. They had wet towels around their mouth, and it was really very hard to breathe. It smelled very, very smoky. Now it seems like most of that lower-level smoke has cleared off, and it's now high in the sky.
Smoke and dust. Do the people coming across the bridge seem to be survivors to you? Do they have that sort of sense
people,
about that?
You know, usually New Yorkers are quite happy to talk to a reporter. The people here are extremely fatigued. The first wave of people over the bridge were people that were shocked. They were in tears. They couldn't find words to talk about what had happened to them. This group of people is just tired. Many of them have been walking for hours in clothing that is totally inappropriate for a walk of that length. And they're exhausted and they shake their heads when I ask them where they've come from. Many, as I say, come from Upper Manhattan.
Yes. Thank you, Andrea.
Thank you.
Andrea Bernstein talking with us from Brooklyn.
NPR's national security correspondent Tom Gelton was at the Pentagon this morning when the aircraft hit the building. He was evacuated with everyone else and reports now on how people reacted.
The Pentagon is a massive building, about 2 miles in perimeter. I entered the building about 10 minutes before the plane struck it. I entered on the east side, directly opposite the site of the crash, and I did not hear or feel the explosion. But Army Lieutenant Colonel Kenny Cox, watching television at the time, was near where the plane hit.
We said, I don't think this is happening. Boom, it happened. So I left out, I came back. We got a crew of five. Air Force, Navy, Marines. We went in, but we couldn't get into them. It was too hot.
The 20,000 or more military and civilian personnel who work at the Pentagon were evacuated quickly, but the attack clearly caused many, many casualties. The Pentagon is built with a series of five concentric rings. The impact of the plane took a huge chunk out of the building, about 75 feet wide. The plane penetrated at least the first two rings, and that section of the building completely collapsed. Rescue forces were quick to arrive, but Rear Admiral Craig Quigley, the Pentagon spokesman, speaking late this afternoon, said the crews were unable to do much at first.
The fire was intense, and only recently have Arlington Search and Rescue people just recently been able to get inside the Pentagon. Fires are still burning very strongly inside the Pentagon. And we know there's a large number of injured, but I have no sense of scale at all.
Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld and other senior Pentagon staff have their offices on the opposite side of the building from where the plane hit, but Admiral Quigley says Rumsfeld reacted quickly.
Secretary Rumsfeld was in his office when the aircraft hit the Pentagon. He went running down to the site where the aircraft hit, was helpful in loading some of the injured onto some stretchers, and then back up into the National Military Command Center. There he has been ever since and will remain for the indefinite future.
The National Military Command Center is the nerve center of the Pentagon. It's staffed 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, and maintains constant touch with U.S. forces around the world. Admiral Quigley says the command center was getting smoky late today, but that operations are continuing there. Elaborate precautions have been made at the Pentagon to protect the building from a terrorist attack on the ground, with a car or a truck bomb, for example. But for all the contingency planning that's been done at the Pentagon over the years, Quigley says this attack was different from what had been anticipated.
We have a variety of security plans to face a variety of conditions, but I think what you've seen here is a full assault on the United States of America.
And that's not something you can prepare for.
Well, I think we were able to evacuate the building very, very quickly. But as far as having some sort of a preparation to defend against an airplane coming in, that's just not something that you see in place.
For the moment, senior officials at the Pentagon are attempting to account for their own colleagues, and they've been unable to look far beyond. A full assault on the United States of America can hardly go unpunished, they say. But how the United States might respond to this attack is not something anyone is yet prepared to contemplate. Tom Gelton, NPR News, Washington.
We're joined now by NPR diplomatic correspondent Mike Schuster. Mike, the World Trade Center has been a target before. Why don't you remind us of when it was bombed and who was responsible?
The World Trade Center was bombed, Robert, in 1993. That bomb at that time killed six and injured hundreds. Four Islamic fundamentalists were later soon arrested for that bombing. And eventually, when the investigation was completed and they went on trial, it was determined that they were actually trying to topple the World Trade Center, exactly as it occurred today. They were convicted in 1994, but the mastermind of their effort to bring down the World Trade Center was a man named Ramzi Youssef, who was out of the country at the time. He was eventually seized by U.S. intelligence agents and the FBI in Pakistan and brought to the United States and put on trial in 1997. And he and a couple of others were also convicted for masterminding the World Trade Center bombing. It's interesting to note that in 1993, Ramzi Youssef also plotted to blow up five airliners in the Far East, but that plot was never consummated. Ramzi Youssef, it's not clear who he was, where he's from. We still don't know who he was representing, if anyone. The one other connection to the World Trade Center bombing was that an Egyptian cleric, Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, was linked to the plot to the World Trade Center bombing in 1993, but put on trial and convicted for conspiracy to blow up other landmarks in New York in 1993, including the Holland Tunnel, the Lincoln Tunnel, the United Nations, and a big federal building.
But in terms of sophistication, today's events involved hijacked airliners, and we can only imagine hijackers who then knew how to fly the aircraft. This is very different from vans packed with explosives.
Certainly it is, but it resembles different terrorist incidents and plots at different times. As I said, Ramzi Youssef tried to bomb five airliners in the Far East. That never happened. Later on in 1998, there were coordinated attacks on two U.S. embassies in Nairobi, Kenya, and in Tanzania. And at that point, experts begin to see the element of coordination entering into terrorist plots. There was the Millennium Plot at the end of 1999 that was uncovered. The ultimate target there was Los Angeles Airport and an attack on American tourists in Jordan and a possible attack on a U.S. naval ship in Yemen. So the element of coordination has emerged in the late 1990s.
And just briefly, in the time that remains, followers of Ramzi Youssef would presumably be suspected here. Who else?
followers of Sheikh Omar Abdul Rahman, certainly Osama bin Laden, because of this element of coordination, which he was linked to the Africa bombings and to this Algerian effort that has recently emerged. Hmm. And there's one other possible suspect, and that's Saddam Hussein. Ramzi Youssef came into the United States with an Iraqi passport, and there were some experts who always believed that Saddam Hussein was behind the first attack on the World Trade Center.
Thank you, Mike.
Thank you, Robert.
NPR diplomatic correspondent Mike Schuster.
Throughout the nation today, virtually every federal agency and many state government agencies heightened security. Schools closed, workers went home. NPR's Brian Naylor joins us now. Brian, starting with Washington, what is the latest thing happening here?
Well, the latest, the Capitol building was shut down. The legislative leaders, congressional leaders, were sent off to an undisclosed secure location. But officials say they want to reopen the Capitol building as soon as possible. That could come as soon as tomorrow in order to emphasize that that it will be back to business as usual, and the Capitol being such a symbol of freedom and of the nation, they want it open again.
And around the country?
Around the country, you know, state capitals closed in places like Florida and West Virginia and Oklahoma City. All state office buildings were closed, and they established a perimeter around the jail where Oklahoma City bombing conspirator Terry Nichols is housed. What's more, the Customs Service said its border crossings were at a threat level one, which is the highest state of alert. They say the borders remained open, but that traffic crossing into the U.S. was subject to the highest level of scrutiny. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission said it was recommending operators of the nation's nuclear power plants to go to their highest level of security, not because of any specific threats, but because of a precaution.
The private sector, needless to say, it has not been business as usual in this country.
There were closures in virtually every American city of large office buildings, the Sears Tower in Chicago, office buildings in Los Angeles. Disneyland and Disney World were closed, and it was certainly not business as usual.
Thanks very much, Brian. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News. This is special coverage from NPR News on today's terrorist attacks. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. Here's a review of today's story. The biggest act of terrorism ever was carried out this morning when four hijacked commercial flights were crashed, two into the World Trade Center towers in New York, one into the headquarters of the U.S. military, and one on the ground outside of Pittsburgh. Government offices around the country were closed. The U.S. military forces around the world were put on the highest alert status.
NPR's Don Gagne is here with us in the studio. Don, earlier you were with the president in Florida, and the president has left there. Where has he gone?
The president first left Florida and went to, the first time we saw him make any kind of an extended statement on this, he was at an air base in Louisiana. We were then told he was going to another undisclosed location, and just in the last hour or so, we found out that he's outside Omaha at another air base, Offutt Air Base, the headquarters of the Strategic Air Command, and he is there until late this evening when we're told he is coming back to the White House.
Well, now, the president and the leaders of Congress were removed to so-called secure locations, I suppose, in the event that they had to conduct government business in some safer place than Washington.
Right, right.
Do we assume that the fact that they're bringing him back to Washington means that people feel that it's all right to be here now?
That's hard to say. They may not have felt comfortable bringing him back here right away when this was unfolding so rapidly today. But I think they may also feel the need to have him back in Washington and to get ready to make some sort of a statement to the American people, though we don't know when that could happen. Vice President Cheney and Condoleezza Rice, his national security advisor, have been at the White House, two of the few people in the White House since this morning, and he has been in contact with them, but again, he will be joining them at the White House tonight.
And we are expecting perhaps a statement from the president. We've just seen sort of fragmentary remarks from him so far, but some sort of major statement?
We will hear something from him, but we can't say at this point when it will be. And it could be late this evening before he actually gets back. So I think while everybody is waiting to hear something from him, we don't know when yet.
Thanks very much, Don.
Thank you.
NPR's White House correspondent Don Gagne.
Americans historically have felt insulated from acts of terrorism such as we experience today. The attacks on the World Trade Center building in New York and the Pentagon in Washington are distinguishable not only for their size, but also for the apparent planning and resources that made them possible. Alan Brinkley is a professor of history at Columbia University in New York. He says today's events will force the country to view its relationship with the rest of the world differently, even as we make efforts to find those responsible for the attacks.
I think what makes this so extraordinary is the enormous scale of what happened today, and the obvious massive conspiracy that was behind it, the large-scale coordination. I mean, so many things happened that are so difficult to do today that it really does make one feel that there's a much larger force at work in this event than was at work in the Oklahoma City bombing or the first World Trade Center bombing or any of the other, you know, sort of scattered terrorist events we've had in the United States.
You have to ask yourself, if somebody was able actually to successfully hijack, more or less successfully hijack, four aircraft, commercial airliners, today in the morning, why couldn't they have done it 2 months ago?
Clearly there is, they have found some way around the security mechanisms we've developed. The airports from which these planes were hijacked are not low security airports. So, I mean, I think that's what is going to take some time to sink in our national psyche, is the magnitude of this event and the total secrecy within which it had been shrouded.
There have been comparisons made and will continue to be made with Pearl Harbor almost 60 years ago. 2,000 people died, and America begins an involvement in a world war. Is it a fair comparison today?
Well, it's a fair comparison and an unfair comparison. I mean, this is not an act of war in any conventional sense. I don't think anybody imagines that there will be an invasion of the United States or that large-scale military activity will at least immediately follow this. One of the central characteristics of our culture throughout our history has been our sense of being protected by the two oceans, that we're somehow separated from the rest of the world and safer in a way than the rest of the world. But I think what this does is demonstrate the falsity of that assumption. We are not protected from the rest of the world. We're part of the world, and that a terrorist event of this scale, which has never happened in any part of the world, to my knowledge, nothing of this magnitude has happened in any other nation, has happened here. It's going to be a very hard thing, I think, for Americans to assimilate.
Professor Brinkley, thank you for your time.
My pleasure.
Alan Brinkley is a professor of American history at Columbia University in New York. Earlier today, we spoke with John Axsom, who was on his way to work when the first plane hit the World Trade Center.
It was such a surreal thing. It's just, I think I commented out loud to the people around me, it looked like the end of the world. And each time I thought it couldn't get worse, it did. The next thing I saw were people jumping from the building. And I will never see anything so horrible in my life. These people just choosing their way of death as opposed to succumbing to flames and smoke, I guess.
What kind of view did you have of them, and how did you know for sure they were jumping?
I was across the street. These were people, I could see their clothes. I saw a gentleman in a red shirt, and his arms weren't waving or nothing. He just calmly jumped, and seven in all, I believe. I didn't see them all. I turned my head in horror, but each time someone else would jump, the whole crowd would break into hysterics. And then the second building went up. I heard no aircraft. I was right across the street. I was still refusing to believe it was an aircraft at that point, but the explosion was deafening. I felt the impact on the back of my head as I turned to run, and I literally thought my shirt caught fire from the heat. It felt like the flames touched me. I know they didn't. I know how ridiculous that is, but it was just that hot. It was that insane. The wind, the debris, people were falling to the ground, and I wanted to stop and help them, but self-preservation told me to just keep going. The building was going to fall, which eventually it did do, but by that point I was four or five blocks away.
Mr. Axsom, thank you for talking with us.
Sure.
Good luck to you, sir.
Thank you.
John Axsom speaking with us from New York earlier today.
Here's a review of today's story about the biggest terrorist attack ever. Both World Trade Center towers collapsed this morning after two hijacked commercial airliners crashed into the skyscrapers. Fire sparked by the collapse continued to burn. The U.S. military headquarters was also attacked. One side of the Pentagon collapsed under another commercial jetliner. A fourth plane crashed on the ground 80 miles outside Pittsburgh. The Federal Aviation Administration has stopped all domestic commercial flights until at least noon tomorrow. Financial markets were closed today and will be closed tomorrow as well. We're following this story throughout the rest of the day and tonight. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.
This is special coverage from NPR News of today's terrorist attacks in New York City and Washington. In Washington, I'm Noah Adams.
I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And in New York, I'm Robert Siegel. Chaos was unleashed today in New York and Washington as the United States was hit by the worst terrorist act in history. Four commercial jets were hijacked and crashed into civilian and military targets, two into the towers of the World Trade Center in Manhattan, one into the Pentagon, and one plane crashed outside Pittsburgh. Hundreds of people were aboard those planes that crashed, and the death toll could be in the thousands. Earlier this afternoon, New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani had this to say to the residents of his city.
Everybody should, in their own way, say a prayer and ask God for help and for assistance, and also ask God to give us the strength to overcome this, because I know we're going to need strength to overcome it. And I want the people of New York to be an example to the rest of the country and the rest of the world that terrorism can't stop us. American democracy is much stronger than vicious, cowardly terrorists, and we're going to overcome this.
You were listening to New York Mayor Rudolph Giuliani. We're joined now by Marianne McCune, who is a reporter with WNYC in New York City. Right now, she is at the major triage center just north of the World Trade Center. A triage center has been set up to handle people being brought out of the building, who are then, I assume, sent on to other hospitals. Marianne, you spent the day downtown at the bombing site. Can you tell us what is going on now at the triage center?
Now it's really just people are poised to receive patients, but the action is more preparation than anything else. They had a triage center set up further south earlier, but because 7 World Trade Center is considered still very dangerous and it's still burning, they moved it up here. Now this is being called Ground Zero. They have a team of ambulances, a team of triage nurses, an area set up for non-critical trauma, psychiatrists, counselors, and clergy. But again, everybody is poised for action. There aren't a lot of patients coming in now. The mayor says that they said earlier that more than 1,000 rescue workers are out there working to get people out, and there are also teams of volunteers from all walks of life all over. But it's dangerous down there, and it's been difficult to get close enough to actually rescue people. We did just have a round of applause on this corner where there are quite a few people now, because a fire truck emerged covered with this thick gray debris that's been blowing everywhere down here. Go ahead.
When you look around you right now down in that part of Manhattan, we were told that it almost has blocked out the sun, the dust and the ash from the collapse of the two buildings.
Absolutely. The smoke has at certain times gotten so strong and high that it's blocked out the sun. The ground is covered with this sort of thick gray dust, and there are papers and pens and all kinds of things that you would imagine came from offices all over the ground. Earlier, I drove over with some triage nurses from a hospital, the hospital that's actually nearest to the World Trade Center, but where the action had died down since this morning. So these triage nurses were looking to go where they could make themselves more useful. But on the way over, it was, I mean, I hate to keep saying this, and I keep hearing people say this, but it looks like a war zone.
Have you talked to people who were in the building and came out of it?
Yes. Earlier in the day, actually, when the first two collapses were happening, I was at the place where people were running to get away from it. So each time there was an explosion or a collapse, there would be a wave of people fearing for their lives, and the first wave would be people who weren't that close, and then more and more people showed up who were covered with soot and describing things like, being on the 87th floor of the World Trade Center and running down 87 flights, getting out just before a collapse happened. People described seeing people jumping out of windows from very high up in the building. And then the dust and the debris after the collapses was so strong that you couldn't see anything. One person described thinking he was lost in a cloud of dust and then being saved by the flash of a photographer's camera.
Marianne, do you have any sense of whether most of the people who were in the building got out or not?
It's very, very difficult to know that at this time. I mean, even the mayor is hesitating to estimate. He said in his press conference that he guessed there were 10,000 people, he said this is a guess, so that there were 10,000 people in the building. And then he talked about, but many of those people may have been rescued. He said that 1,500 people were brought over to New Jersey, the New Jersey shore on ferries, so certainly that many were saved, and 600 people have, this was earlier in the day he was saying this, but the 600 were treated in local hospitals,
right.
150 removed by EMS, but now it's just very difficult to tell.
Thanks very much, Marianne.
Thank you.
Marianne McCune is a reporter with WNYC in New York City.
Our colleague Robert Siegel is also in New York. Robert, the difficult thing here, I guess, throughout this day is to avoid panic among the people there.
Yeah, I think what I saw today, and this was in Midtown Manhattan, so it wasn't immediately in the area of destruction. It wasn't panic. People were obviously very anxious. I didn't hear much gallows humor from anyone. This was not like a blackout where there's some element of fun to it, not at all. On the other hand, although I guess we really won't know what truly happened all over New York City today for a while, I didn't get any sense of violence or looting or anything like that.
In the city, the mass transit, let's say people mm-hmm. wanting to leave that city very quickly this morning, the subways were shut down, the bridges were closed. How could people do that?
Subways were shut down. Buses were still running. Service was not full, but a bus would pass periodically, and they would be packed with people. The logistical feat of New Yorkers getting to work, of people coming from the outer boroughs, from the suburbs of the city, in and then out every day, is fairly miraculous without something like this happening. Then for New Yorkers to get to work, drop off children, collect them at the end of the school day, and put all that together is a rather difficult piece of urban logistics. If you can imagine how complicated this was as people tried to get back to their homes early in the morning without benefit of trains, simply headed walking in the right direction, tried to hitch rides with vans as they came. Then you'd learn that one tunnel or bridge was open, but only outbound. Lots of people improvised. Lots of people walked enormous distances today.
I suppose, too, there was throughout this day sort of a desperate need for people to get in touch with spouses and with children throughout the city.
Yes. I mean, the difference between an event like this and anything even remotely similar that might have happened 10 years ago is the soundtrack of it is thousands of people in cell phone conversations talking with somebody, a loved one, or calling the office, or just trying to tell someone, I'm okay. I wasn't at the office yet this morning, so I'm all right. So that was going on constantly. And at every payphone, you'd see a line of people waiting to get to the payphone, obviously to connect up with people at home or with the caregiver of the children to explain what to do with the kid if you were stranded in Manhattan.
New Yorkers have been tested before, of course, but never on this scale.
Nothing has ever happened like this, and the measure of the magnitude of it is that as you walk around Midtown Manhattan and you look south and you look downtown, you would think that there is a huge fire perhaps 10 blocks away, and then you realize, no, that cloud of smoke that's hanging over Manhattan is the cloud of debris and smoke and dust that's gone up from where the World Trade Center towers should be. It is vast, and it is oppressive.
Thank you, Robert.
Thank you, Noah.
Our colleague Robert Siegel in New York.
NPR's Steve Inskeep has been around the city of Washington today checking out reports of car bombs and other attacks. He spent most of his time at the Pentagon, where one of the hijacked planes crashed into the building shortly after 9:30 this morning. Steve, can you walk us through what happened in Washington today?
Well, Linda, I suppose the best place to witness the beginning of this day, and it's unfortunate to phrase it that way, was on top of a hill not too far from the Pentagon. I spoke to a gentleman who was here in Arlington this morning. He said he heard an enormous roar. He looked up just in time to see a plane flying very low overhead, flying so fast, he said, that he had no idea even what kind of a plane it was. And then that aircraft smashed into the Pentagon. We're looking right now, Linda, and I hope you can hear me as a helicopter passes over. We're looking right now at the result of that, an enormous gap in the Pentagon, in the wall. We're told that this plane crashed through the outer ring of offices, through a courtyard, through the next ring of offices, through another courtyard, and into the third ring, and the flames burned intensely for quite some time. Just now does it look like they're beginning to get the fire almost under control and the smoke is diminishing.
But with all that, apart from the area of the direct hit, people were evacuated from the Pentagon office building.
People were evacuated from the Pentagon office buildings, that's correct. And it's interesting that some people had different reactions, though. There were, we're told, and I've met a number of people today, who actually went toward the fire, actually went toward the explosion and tried to find people, tried to help people, tried to bring them out. Pentagon officials have told us that at least one man who did this, who was outside the building, raced into the building, tried to bring people out, and was severely burned as a result. So there are quite a few stories of heroism here. Other people have simply tried to stay out of the way and kept a nervous eye on the sky. There have been false alarms and alerts all over Washington today, alarms about possible attacks on the State Department, on the Capitol, alarms about more airplanes in the sky, unidentified, and questions about where they were heading. On a couple of occasions here at the Pentagon, people went running away from the building at the urging of the police in order to stay clear in case another aircraft were to crash. But for the most part, people have stayed calm.
When I was out earlier today, I noticed that the only planes in the air were military aircraft. What is the military doing in this country and around the world?
Well, the military has put itself on what they call Force Protection Condition Delta. And what you need to know is that that is the highest state of alert that they have. They've changed the alert system they used to have during the Cold War. And U.S. military forces around the world are on their highest state of alert and prepared, we presume, to act, although, of course, the first question is, if you're going to strike back, what do you do? In the meantime, two American aircraft carriers have shoved off from Norfolk today. They've headed up the East Coast simply to be in position to assist in any way that they can, providing helicopters or other transport, hospital facilities, anything else, with the damage here in Washington and also up the coast in New York City.
Thanks very much, Steve Inskeep.
Happy to help.
NPR's Steve Inskeep will be back in a moment with more special coverage of today's attacks on New York and Washington, D.C. This is NPR. This is special coverage from NPR News on today's terrorist attacks. I'm Linda Wertheimer.
And I'm Noah Adams. In a time of national crisis, we are used to turning to the federal agencies in Washington for regular updates and news conferences. That has not happened today. The only federal official we've seen, except for brief remarks by the president, was his assistant, Karen Hughes. She spoke this afternoon at the FBI to assure the country the president is working on the issue.
He is in continuous communication with the vice president and key members of his cabinet and national security team. Vice President Cheney and our national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice, are in a secure facility at the White House. I have just come from there. The Secretary of Transportation and other members of our White House senior staff are gathered at a command center there, and we are coordinating with other branches of our federal government.
Bush aide Karen Hughes speaking earlier today. We're joined now by NPR's Barbara Bradley. Barbara, you've been at the FBI. What's going on in official Washington right now?
Well, as far as the FBI is concerned, we don't know a whole lot about what's going on. I've been standing outside of the FBI building since the first thing in the morning. The only statement, the only official statement that they would give us is that, first, they have dispatched investigative teams to all the disaster sites. Second, that their first priority is to help the wounded. And finally, that they're working with other government agencies. So it's not been a whole lot of communication.
So when you don't have things being given to you by people in government, what do you do? How do you find out what's happening?
Well, you know, you make phone calls when the cell phone is working, which today didn't work a whole lot. Today I spoke to a longtime FBI profiler, Clint Van Zandt, who's an expert on terrorism and specifically has been watching a major suspect, Osama bin Laden. And Van Zandt said that the U.S. did have some early warning signs. For example, someone from his organization wrote a British newspaper last week and threatened an attack on the U.S. And there was an earlier warning about 3 weeks ago. And at least Van Zandt said that he was not surprised about the timing since, as you know, one of bin Laden's top lieutenants was about to be sentenced tomorrow in New York City for his role in the bombings of the two U.S. embassies in Africa.
So with the warnings that apparently were out there, why could this attack not have been predicted?
You know, we get dozens of warnings every week, sometimes every day, and it's really nearly impossible to know which ones are legitimate or not. Experts say it takes a long time to get the infrastructure for this kind of strike in place. I mean, you have to train the pilots, you have to do the logistics, the planning, you have to raise some money. But once that plan is set up, the strike can happen at any time, and they can just choose to wait until a significant date. And that may be what's happened this time.
Now, tell us, is anything known about any of the victims in any of the deaths at the Trade Center or the other airline crashes today?
I don't believe we know we don't know the specific number of victims yet, even. We don't even know that. We do know the identity of one victim. She was Barbara Olson, who's a very influential Republican activist and is also the wife of the Solicitor General, Theodore Olson. She was on the American Airlines plane that crashed into the Pentagon, and apparently she was able to call her husband and say that the plane was being hijacked and that all the passengers had been moved to the back of the plane. And then, of course, the plane crashed into the Pentagon. It's kind of a chilling scene to think of.
Thank you, Barbara. NPR's Barbara Bradley.
The federal government sent workers home mid-morning today, shortly after the American Airlines plane crashed into the Pentagon. Federal workers poured out of buildings in downtown Washington, creating a citywide traffic jam as they tried to make their way home, adding to difficulties for ambulances and fire trucks trying to reach the Potomac River bridges on the way to the destruction at the Pentagon. Patricia Rivera of Denver and Phil Gentry of Portland, Oregon, were in the city for a meeting at the Small Business Administration. Their meeting was canceled for now, and they were walking toward the bridges.
For the first time in my life, I saw cops with guns, and I'm in the street, M16s, and I've never seen that.
You have to treat this almost as a war zone, and the safe thing is to not be where there's visible buildings that might be of interest to terrorists, or on the subway would be one of those. So we're walking and trying to stay away from the main federal buildings.
Near the arena where Washington's basketball teams play, we ran into Erica Thornburg, who, along with some colleagues from the Veterans Administration, decided to go to lunch.
The streets are blocked, people aren't moving, the police are trying to direct traffic. Most of us don't have enough gas to get home if we're going to be sitting in traffic like this for 3 hours. So we might as well eat.
George Ray was walking away from the mall in the complex of federal office buildings, hand in hand with his wife, Betty. He'd hiked over from his offices at Housing and Urban Development to find her.
I could see out my window the billowing smoke coming out of the Pentagon. This is terrible, this panic in the streets. We'd never thought we would be attacked like this. Never, ever.
And I think the worst part of it is trying to get in touch with your loved one. But as you can see, the streets are just packed. No one's moving. Cars are standing in place for half an hour or an hour more, just still at the same stoplight.
From the glittering white obelisk of the Washington Monument to the immense dome of the Capitol, the Washington Mall looked almost normal. But the people drifting along its paths were workers sent home. Smoke was rising over the Smithsonian Museum from the fire at the Pentagon, and the white buildings bathed in bright sunshine were completely empty, evacuated, including the Capitol building and the six big office buildings that house members of the House and Senate. There was a loose cordon of Capitol police keeping people off the grounds. A few people across Constitution Avenue gathered in the deep shade of the park. We passed a parked car where a dozen people were gathered around a car radio, and we stopped for a moment to listen as a limousine driver gave directions to pedestrians trying to get home.
Andrews is shut down.
So the green line is running.
The green line is open.
Oh, okay.
This is my job. I know the city. I've been paying attention to what's been going on the radio.
And every bit of information that I get, I just pass on. This is total gridlock right here.
That was Jess Pipkin, who parked his limousine on the mall this morning and tried to help.
Here is a review of today's story about the biggest terrorist attack ever. Right now, medical centers in New York are treating people injured in this morning's attacks. Two hijacked commercial jetliners crashed into both of the World Trade Center towers. The towers caught on fire and then collapsed into the street below. And this afternoon, another building at the World Trade Center complex has collapsed. Police estimate that thousands of people have been injured and killed in New York. The Pentagon was also attacked. We'll be following this story throughout the rest of the day and tonight. You're listening to special coverage from NPR News.